Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens.
At whose expense? Like so many other businesses, Illinois-based Learning Resources is suffering because of Donald Trump's tariffs. But unlike other businesses, the family-run company is fighting back publicly. A VP tells us they're feeling hopeful after making their case at the Supreme Court.
And an amuse bouche. A BC woman was delighted to see a moose on her property, but concerned that it would get hit by a car on the highway. So she called in the Mounties, who used a Canadian flag to steer it to safety. I know.
All true. Those stories and more coming up for you on the Thursday edition of As It Happens.
It is 6:01, and you're tuned in to As It Happens here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from the Northland Foundation, working within Northeast Minnesota, offering grants, small business supports, and programs to help people and communities, working toward a future where everyone feels they belong and can thrive. More at northlandfdn.org. Support for KAXE comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. Now I'm going to play a song for you. This is Buddy Guy featuring Mavis Staples with We Go Back.
Cup of coffee cost a nickel. Newspaper sold for a dime. A dollar bought a pack of smoke and a bottle of Mad Dog wine. We go back, yeah, when the blues was everywhere. We go back, fighting hard to get our share. Times were bad, what a time we had. We go back, way, way back.
On a balcony in Memphis, April of 1968. I never will forget what happened on that date. We go back when the blues were everywhere. We go back fighting to get our share. Time for band, but what a time we had. We go back, way, way, way back.
Still hear it in my ears, the crying and the dying, the hell it took to get us here.
We go back when the blues was everywhere. To get our share. Time for band, but what a time we had. We go back.
We go back. We go way, way back.
back to the hometown where my grandma was. Lived in the Magruder home, right on Highway 61. We had such a hard time, oh, but we made it, we made it. We had faith in grace. We believed we could make it, and we did.
And that's Buddy Guy with Mavis Staples with the song We Go Back.
I remember when.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight,
Playing for Keeps, an educational toy company, takes its case against the U.S. president's tariffs all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Unsafe space. In Chicago, ICE agents arrest a daycare teacher in front of the kids. An alderman tells us that shattered people's sense of safety, not just at one school, but at schools across the city.
There's nada more Canada in a story that sounds like someone from another country's idea of what happens in this country. A Mountie uses a Canadian flag to help steer a moose to safety.
And pulling the rug out from on top of them. At last, the UK loosens its rules for lawyers and allows them not to wear hot, uncomfortable horsehair wigs in court if they're really itching not to. As It Happens, the Thursday edition, radio that knew the system was wigged. A wine importer, several state governors, and an educational toy company. Not a group you'd necessarily expect to share a ton of common interests, but that was the coalition that pushed a legal case against the Trump administration's tariffs all the way to the Supreme Court this week, arguing that there are major holes in the national emergency designation the president used to bypass Congress and enact the trade policy. Alana Ruffman is a vice president and member of the family behind Learning Resources, the toy company that's among the litigants. We reached her in Chicago.
Alana, I know you were in Washington yesterday as the Supreme Court justices heard from the lawyers arguing this case. How are you feeling about how things went?
Sure. We're feeling positive after the hearing yesterday. Nobody knows what will happen until the decision comes out in a couple of months. But the lines of questioning and the quality of the discussion from the justices was really great. And, you know, we observed that the justices are somewhat skeptical of the IEEPA tariffs.
As our listeners heard, this is a family business. You sell educational toys. Did you ever think that you would be at the Supreme Court?
Oh, gosh. You know, this has definitely been a very unique experience. We are a 109-year-old family business. We're headquartered outside of the Chicago area. When the reciprocal tariffs were announced, it became very disruptive to our business because we manufacture all over the world. And at its core, what this meant was a very big unplanned tax increase. And so we had to start making all sorts of changes to how we run our business. And one of the things that we decided to do was to pursue litigation because we felt as if the tariffs were illegal.
How much money have you paid out this year so far in tariffs?
Well, last year we paid just over $2 million in all tariffs and duties across our range. This year in 2025, we project we will pay $14 million in just IEEPA tariffs. So that's on top of whatever we would be paying in just our typical course of business. We don't have $14 million just sitting around in a closet waiting to pay to the government. We had to change the way that our business runs to be able to cover this cost.
A lot of other businesses, of course, and I'm sure you're commiserating at different times, but they're facing similar challenges. They have tried to quietly lobby the government for exceptions on these tariffs, or they've accepted the tariffs as something beyond their control and are rolling with it as best they can. Why did you and your family decide, your business, to fight them in court?
Well, for a couple of reasons. First of all, we have 500 employees, and we had to be able to respond to those 500 employees when they started looking around and saying, what's going to happen to our business if we have to pay 145% in tariffs on our products? At that point, we were looking at a $100 million tariff bill, which is more than every single cost in our company. And so we needed to do something, and when we started to look into it in the IEEPA statute, we determined that we felt as if the statute did not provide for tariffs. Nowhere in the statute does it use the word tariff, tax, duty, or any synonym to that. And so we felt strong in our legal position that this was not authorized and it was executive overreach. And so we started to pursue legal action.
The Trump administration's argument there's been a few threads to that argument, as you know, that tariffs are just a bitter pill American businesses need to swallow to try to bring industry back to the States, that ultimately this will be better for all Americans and American businesses. And the other, they've said, you know, border crises, trade deficits are justification for pushing these through without congressional sign-off. How are you and your lawyers responding to those lines of argument?
Sure. Well, it may surprise you to know that the U.S. is actually our second biggest manufacturing hub. So it's not as if we don't manufacture here. The issue is that we can't only manufacture here. And so as a school supplier, we have a responsibility to get them the best product at the best price. So for instance, plastic products and toys in particular, the most efficient manufacturing for that is outside of the U.S.
This administration, as you know, for people who are vocal and public about their disagreement and who push back, are often punished for it. Did that give you any pause?
You know what? When we were faced with do or die, meaning we were facing an asphyxiating tax on our business, to us it felt like a simple decision for what to do. We live in a wonderful country that affords us the opportunity to raise our hand if we feel like something is happening that does not pass the muster test, if it's illegal. And so, you know, we pursued those avenues, and ultimately this is not a political issue. It's really a constitutional interpretation challenge. And our Constitution gives taxation power to Congress. And that was very intentional. There's a lot of reasons why the Founding Fathers did that. And so that's really all that we're bringing up here. There are a lot of different ways that the government can implement tariffs. And so IEEPA just isn't one of them.
Ultimately, what would victory look and feel like to you?
You know, we want to be able to create educational products for the schools and families that use them around the world at the best quality and the best price for our customers. And so that's what we want to do. We want to be able to go out there and make high-quality, innovative products that address needs and help children meet their developmental milestones. So that's really what we're focused on, and that's what we want to get back to.
And so overturning of the tariffs and perhaps a refund to what you've already paid?
Certainly a refund would be great. Refunds are likely, and remedies in general, are likely to take quite a bit of time to figure out. So that is going to require a big administration process by the government.
Yeah. You're not hopeful about that, but overturning at least would let you breathe a bit.
Well, I wouldn't say I'm not hopeful about it. I guess I would say that we don't know exactly how the court system would handle that.
Sure.
So it's likely that the Supreme Court would delegate that down to a lower court to figure out how remedies would work. And reality is that it's likely going to take quite a bit of time for that to funnel through the system.
Alana, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Alana Ruffman is the VP of Marketing for the Illinois toy company Learning Resources. We reached her in Chicago. It began like any other morning, parents of babies and toddlers hurrying out the door to drop the kids off at daycare before heading to work. But just as the Spanish language Rayito de Sol Early Learning Center in Chicago opened its doors yesterday, immigration and customs enforcement agents showed up. They followed one of the daycare instructors into the parking lot, then they followed her into the building, and then they dragged her, screaming, out of the building. Tara Gudarzi is the mother of a student at the daycare who took part in a press conference after the teacher was detained yesterday.
I am horrified by what has happened here today. Our community has been shattered. Our families have been traumatized. The children were crying. The parents were crying. There was no warrant. They don't care about documentation. My understanding from what I've seen and from what I've heard is that numerous laws were violated today. It's a scene that I don't think any of us have ever witnessed before and will ever forget.
Chicago mother and lawyer Tara Gudarzi speaking to reporters after a teacher at her child's daycare was violently detained by ICE officials yesterday. Matt Martin is the alderman for Chicago's 47th Ward, where the daycare is located. That's where we reached him.
Alderman Martin, what is your sense of how the families that are, you know, part of this daycare community, how are they doing today?
I think they're holding up as well as one can, but so many are feeling shocked and outraged. There's this sense that this feeling of safety that permeated the school, as is the case with so many schools, has been shattered, and it's going to take a long, long time and a lot of work to put those pieces back together.
How did you find out that this ICE raid was happening inside a daycare in your ward?
A volunteer in our local community who keeps tabs on a number of different schools flagged for my office that ICE was active at a nearby daycare. So I drove down there, got there about 30 minutes or so after the ICE agents had left. And what was told to me was that a teacher at this daycare caring for and educating toddlers and infants was violently dragged out of the daycare. And as that was happening, there were other parents and other teachers saying, please stop doing this. This is a daycare. There are children here. You are not welcome. And it was just horrific, something that should never happen. And in fact, up until January of this year, our federal government has prohibited from happening for decades. But sadly, the Trump administration rescinded those policies. And now we have this.
There's video of some of this, and the woman is heard saying, quote, I have papers. We're hearing that she's from Colombia originally. She's known as Ms. Diana or Diana to the students, Diana or Diana Santillana Galeano. What do you know about where she is, how she's doing right now?
I understand that she's at a facility in Broadview, which is a suburb of Chicago, where many people who have been taken off the streets by ICE agents go for several hours or several days at a time. Just earlier today, a federal judge declared that the conditions of that facility likely violate our federal constitution, that there are not adequate sleeping arrangements, there are not adequate sanitary arrangements, there's no food provided on site. Instead, you get a partial sandwich a few times a day, and it's very, very rare that a person there is able to talk with their attorney. So it's truly deplorable conditions. And I hope that those conditions change, especially after the federal court's order.
I know you were involved in organizing a rally yesterday, but what else is happening to try to help?
We have, thankfully, a community that's always looking out for one another. And so there is a petition that is being circulated. There is an active GoFundMe page that is helping ensure that there are resources for Miss Diana as she fights her case in court. And this is not the first time that our community has come together. There was a gentleman a few weeks ago, Ruben Torres, whose daughter is a high school student in my community, battling stage 4 cancer, receiving very aggressive treatment. She was in a hospital for 30 days, was allowed to come home for the weekend, and he thought he would go to a Home Depot to pick up a few extra hours just to make ends meet because he's the primary income earner in the family. He was also violently taken from ICE, but after a lot of good work, including by his attorneys, he was released just the other week, thankfully. So people came together in support of that family, and I'm seeing them do the same thing for Miss Diana.
The U.S. Department of Homeland Security, DHS, you may have seen, is claiming that its officers tried to conduct a traffic stop of her vehicle and that she ran into the daycare to avoid them and, in their words, quote, recklessly endangering the children inside, unquote. You've also seen and heard, the dehumanizing language that is used to describe folks that they're trying to take into custody. That kind of language, what do you do with that when it is repeated over and over again?
You know, that's truly hard to hear. I think we always need to acknowledge one another's shared humanity, especially in times when we might disagree with one another, because absent that, things might devolve in a way where the worst can happen. You just can't have armed federal ICE agents going into daycares, which obviously has happened. They've done this at hospitals. They've done this on people's private property in their yards. Like, this has to stop.
There are those who hear that language from DHS, see these actions, and believe that, you know, this is necessary. They might infer or assume that she did something, that the people in this situation have done something. What would you want to say to people who still are thinking along those lines?
I'd say think about the families at this daycare. Think about their children. Think about the educators. And the fact that they have spent so much time, I was there at their ribbon cutting a few years ago, so they've spent several years now cultivating this sense of safety and security and a true nurturing environment that was torn apart yesterday. It's going to take a long time for that to be recaptured. And no one should ever have to experience what the children, the parents, and the teachers had to endure yesterday. No justification whatsoever.
Have you ever come face-to-face with these ICE agents who are about to do this? Have you ever spoken to them?
No, I've not.
If you could, what would you say?
I think I would uplift how much pain and uncertainty they've created in my community. And just want them to know, want them to hear that from me directly, how harmful their actions are, how in so many instances they're unlawful, they're unconstitutional, and that when any of us are getting into government service at any level of government here, it should be in service of our community's benefits, our community needs. And to be clear, we do need federal government help on a number of levels. There's so many ways in which the federal government could help Chicago become a safer and a stronger and more economically vibrant place. What ICE is continuing to do is doing the exact opposite.
Alderman Martin, I appreciate this. Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Matt Martin is the alderman for Chicago's 47th Ward. That's where we reached him. Just a heads up, some listeners might consider this next story too Canadian. It prominently features a Canadian flag, the Mounties, and an iconic Canadian wild animal. So just fair warning. The story took place on Shauna McAllister's property in British Columbia. We reached Ms. McAllister in Clinton.
Shauna, so it's a typical morning last week. You're having a coffee, you're looking out at your beautiful property, and then you notice something. What stuck out?
So I look out and I see these big floppy ears poking out from behind a tree near the front gate. And then some big long legs step out and I think, that's not my horse. What is that? And then these big giant legs come striding out from behind the tree. And I thought, is that what I think it is? It's got a goatee. Oh. It's got big floppy ears. It's got a hump on its back.
It was a moose.
And had you, I mean, you clearly know the markers of a moose. You were able to identify it once it started walking out from behind those trees. But is this a regular sight for you?
Definitely not. I had been asking locals in Clinton since I moved in February, hey, have you seen any moose? Have you seen moose? Because I see these be careful of moose on the road signs all over, but I haven't seen one yet. Oh. And I desperately wanted to see a moose.
And then your dream came. There it was. Your dream came true. And so you could have just marveled, you know, at the sight of this majestic creature and taken some photos and then you could go about your day. But you know, you were invested in this. You were worried about what might happen.
Well, I first went out in my slippers and my house coat, and my horses were walking beside me because my horses were like, what is that? What is that? And my dogs I put in the house because they're like, what is that? So me and the horses walked towards this moose, and then the moose sort of looked at me and walked slowly along the fence. And I thought, okay, I'm just going to let him be, and I'm going to go back in the house and see what happens in about an hour.
And then?
And then I come out in about an hour dressed and ready for action, and I go looking for him. I didn't know if he was still in the yard or if he jumped over the fence again. And there he was, just standing there staring in the like 8 o'clock, 8:30 a.m. beautiful sunlight on his brown fur, standing in a little grove of trees.
Oh.
As I approached him, he dropped his head, a sign of submission, I think, lolling his tongue out either side. And I just kept approaching him. And I thought, okay, well, I want to see if he's injured because this isn't normal. And then as I approached, I saw, okay, he's probably still young. He's got the little nubs for horns. And his mother may have been the one that was killed north of the property a few days previous. And maybe he came from that along the highway. He just seemed very, very calm. And so I felt that he just needed some respite. So there he was napping in the sunshine. And I came right up to him, like maybe 5 feet away. And as I was coming up, his little nose was twitching in a dream. And then he sat up. His ears flopped around because they're big, heavy, donkey-like ears. And then he saw me, and then his eyes slowly closed. And about 10 seconds later, he was back asleep, dreaming with his nose twitching in the sunshine.
That sounds so beautiful. But you called conservation officials, right?
So when I went back in the house the second time, I thought, okay, this little dude, he's going to jump the fence onto the highway. He's going to kill some passerbys and kill himself. Like, this has to get dealt with. So they drove onto the property like the troops coming to help.
Yes.
And they parked their vehicles at the gate. Well, and they got out with that air rifle. And I thought, mean business here.
Yeah, I saw this photograph. I saw this photograph in the CBC News coverage, Shauna. There's some hands trying to help. There's a Canadian flag. RCMP is involved. What is that picture telling? Like, what is happening there? Because clearly this moose did not want to move on.
So he absolutely was not going to budge. He was going to stay on my property and just maybe have like a little holiday. I have no idea what he thought. So the police show up and the conservation show up and they get out of their vehicle. They've got the air rifle. They look very serious and very like intense. And so then I say, wait, don't go yet. I got a big giant Canadian flag and the pole will help you in case he turns aggressive and attacks you. You can protect yourself. And maybe the flag part will scare him and shoot him off the property. So they took the flag and they marched off across the field and disappeared into the trees. And then I waited and waited and waited. 40 minutes later, I'd heard several air rifle shots, no sign of life. And I'm thinking, they're all dead. Like, what? Oh. What's happened?
No.
So I know, I was so, so scared because moose are notoriously aggressive. So I go creeping through the field, peeking through the trees, and there's the one local police officer kindly talking to the moose, saying, come on, little buddy, we got to get you out of here. So then I just march straight up to his snout, and the officers are standing nearby, and I say, come on, little buddy, come, baby, come follow Auntie, it's time to go. And he immediately did, right behind me. So then the cop with the flag is beside him on one side, the other cop with the little stick are leading like right beside him, escorting him off the property, and he's following like a big pet dog. And that's where you see the photos of the police just escorting him down the road with the snow flying around, the Canadian flag waving in the wind.
I mean, it's basically the heritage moment writes itself. Have you seen any sightings since?
No, and I look all the time because I think, where's my moose baby friend? He just galloped off in the forest fine. So all is well that ends well.
Shauna, I'm glad we could speak. Thank you for this.
Thank you.
Shauna McAllister recently escorted a moose to safety. We reached her in Clinton, BC. For centuries, there has been an enduring problem in the British justice system, and it's a real head-scratcher. In the 17th century in England, wearing a wig was all the rage. It was positively de wigger. Yeah, you hated that. But King Charles II would have made me his court jester for that joke. Yep. Anyway, then judges started wearing wigs, and then lawyers. It became a tradition to sport a wig in the courtroom, and then it became a rule. These wigs have changed a little over the years, but you're picturing the right ones, those dingy off-white things with the weird curls at the side. They are not cool, as in they are not fashionable anymore, and also they are uncomfortably hot. Also, they're traditionally made of horsehair, and they're tight and itchy, so you could describe them as your mane squeeze. I'm telling you, King Charles would love this stuff. He would have you beheaded for not laughing. He would have me beheaded later on, but still. Anyway, I'm sorry. Good news. Britain's Bar Council conducted a 2-year review of the whole wig situation, and now the wigs and the rules have been loosened. If you have an afro or locks, if you're going through menopause, if you're pregnant, or if you have any disability that makes the wig a challenge, you no longer have to wear that itchy taupe on top. Now, the British tabloids are acting like someone banned crumpets, but this is just a sensible, practical decision. And a lot of thought went into these changes. They didn't just come up with them off the top of their heads. Here's Lionel Hampton with Loose Wig. With Loose Wig.
We are going to take a short break now. When we return, our latest Hometown Edition takes you to Hay River, Northwest Territories.
The town has faced disasters in recent years, from fires to floods, but it's also helped others face disasters, stepping in to host out-of-towners dealing with crises of their own.
And we'll also hear from a local who says spending most of his days out in the woods, taking pictures of birds, has transformed his life. Stay tuned. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. We'll be right back.
is 6:35, and you're tuned in to As It Happens, a CBC program here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 7 o'clock, it's going to be On the River with your volunteer host, Alyssa Ellen. They'll be from 7 to 10 p.m. We receive support from the McKnight Foundation. Support for KAXE comes from the Timberlake Restaurant in Grand Rapids, featuring Martini Monday each week from 5 to 8 p.m. More information is available at TimberlakeLodgeHotel.com. The Virginia Public Library offers a genealogy assistance program the second Thursday of the month at 4 p.m. Whether you're just starting out or fine-tuning your research, all are welcome. The classic movie series continues at the Edge Center for the Arts in Big Fork Thursday, November 13th. This month's film is Rio Bravo, starring John Wayne, Dean Martin, and Ricky Nelson. The movie starts at 6:30. Now back to As It Happens.
Hello again and welcome back. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens, the Thursday edition, part two. Coming up,
Northern composure. In tonight's Hometown Edition, we visit Hay River Northwest Territories, which has proven resilient even while battling fires and floods.
Out of house and home. 2 years after wildfire devastated the hamlet of Enterprise, some of its former residents are still living in Hay River. Now that Enterprise is preparing to elect a new council, they're worried their voices won't be heard.
Digging deep, when a local school unearthed a 25-year-old time capsule, it brought up complicated memories for parents who'd since lost their children, in some cases to overdoses. But one mother remains determined to make the future better.
And a bird in the hand is worth hours in the bush. We'll meet a man who devotes much of each day to patiently waiting in the woods for wildlife.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Hay River edition of As It Happens. Stay tuned.
Hay River knows what it's like to be in trouble, and it knows what it's like to help people out. In 2023, when fire threatened the town on two separate occasions, the feeling was uncomfortably familiar. It had been just 1 year since serious floods, and people were still recovering. In the aftermath of that fire season, the nearby hamlet of Enterprise was in ruins. Hay River then became host to several families who fled that destruction. Years on, many of those evacuees are still in Hay River. During this summer's wildfire season, the town briefly welcomed even more people who had to leave their homes in another nearby town, Fort Providence. Reverend Francis Delaplaine says Hay River is uniquely equipped to host these visitors.
Here we were, this three-time evacuated community, now receiving evacuees in our community. And what we saw was a tremendous amount of empathy and care and concern for the evacuees that came, because many of our community members had experienced these evacuations and these losses themselves. And so I really saw a community that had a tremendous amount of care and concern because we had experienced this. And so people, you know, had a sense of what was being felt.
Reverend Francis Delaplaine is the rector of St. Andrew's Anglican Church in Hay River. Winnie Cadieux knows what it's like to pack up and leave. She and her husband lost their home in Enterprise in 2023. Years later, she is still living in Hay River, and that's about to have another impact on her immediate future. We reached Ms. Cadieux in Hay River.
Winnie, you've lived in Hay River for 2 years now, if my math is right. And our listeners will remember we've spoken to you a couple of times and started when all of this first unfolded. How are you and your family doing right now?
Actually, you know, Neil, we're doing better.
What has helped you get to that place?
I think time, more than anything, you know, time and support from friends and family, and just being together with family that have suffered the same devastation we have, and working through the various issues that we have encountered.
That's good to hear, Winnie. Where does Enterprise fit into your future plans at this point?
Well, that's a big question, because as you've probably heard at a recent meeting in Enterprise, residents who have not moved back to Enterprise as of December 2024, so 1 year ago, are no longer being considered residents. So we've lost our privilege of voting and running for the council, you know, participating fully, I think, in the rebuilding of Enterprise.
It sounds like that hurts a lot. Like it's another severing of a tie.
Oh, you got that right. It was difficult, you know, after the devastation of the fire. There was hope there, right? I mean, we always felt we were going to go back. We had our property. The government was helping clean it up so that we could rebuild. Going through all that, and then thinking that you are still part of the community, and then being told that you retroactively are not, was a punch in the gut and a wake-up call, I think.
So does that mean that you are slowly putting that dream of going back to Enterprise away, or is it still in your mind a matter of time?
That's the question now, a matter of time, and how will we go back, you know? Will we go back as a resident and then in, you know, more than a year from when we go back, become eligible again to vote and run for election, or will we go back, you know, we have had a business there, so will we go back just in the form of a business venture? Right. That's what's on the table right now.
2 years since the fire, a lot of rebuilding, mm-hmm. as you've said, which will always takes time. The government has said the eligibility rules are written into legislation and are firm. So, you know, does that help in your mind ease the questions, or answer the questions rather, of why officials think they can't make exceptions indefinitely?
Nobody asked them to do it indefinitely. We understood the Election Act, but in the Hamlets Act, it like the minister had the option to have an administrator in there for an indefinite period of time, and chose to do a finite period of time, which wasn't very long, June till September. They did have a strategic planning session in July, and being allowed to participate in that gave us hope as well. So it's been like these little threads thrown out there for hope and then yanked away from you.
The election, to let our listeners know, in Enterprise is slated for December 8th. It's the first one since Enterprise was placed under an administrator earlier this year. Do you think the community is ready for a vote?
No, I don't. And, you know, it was pointed out in the strategic planning sessions that we had by a gentleman who lost his home and is still living in Enterprise in temporary accommodation. He pointed out that he definitely felt there should not be an election because the hamlet was not mentally well enough as a community to go forward. And it was so good to hear that, because we all knew we were struggling with something. Like, why, you know, we felt rebuilding the community was a good idea, getting together for talking about that. But there was nobody there that felt going ahead with an election was a good idea. I think that was part of the problem in the beginning, you know, putting so much pressure on the elected officials to work through the devastation.
But having that kind of clarity, would that not help the rebuilding efforts, having, you know, leadership in place?
I don't know if it would. You know, to me, the administrator coming in gave an authority that took the politics out of the mix. And things should have been easier. You know, decisions should have been easier because it was the might of the government behind this man making decisions for the community through public consultation.
A spokesperson for the territory's Department of Municipal and Community Affairs told our producer mm-hmm. that it is always the plan to remove the administrator eventually, that there will be ultimately a supervisor in place to guide the new council. Is that something that reassures you?
I hope it works out. I really do. Like, I will never lose my hope for Enterprise. Mm. I always hope that it can grow back strong. But I don't know that I see that right now.
Are you going to be able to vote in Hay River?
That's been something I asked myself, too. I mean, as up until October 7th, I thought I was still a resident in Enterprise. So I never, you know, even after living here a year, I didn't go to the town council and say, okay, I'm now a Hay River mm-hmm. resident. Can I vote? So that's still something I'm not sure about, you know.
Has all of this, Winnie, has all of this changed how you think about the idea of home?
That's a good question. The idea, well, to me, the idea of home, I mean, I certainly talk about Enterprise having been my home, but my home is where my family is. It's not just a place. It's a feeling, and I guess, like they say, home is where the heart is, and my heart's with my family. So if Enterprise doesn't work out again for me or the rest of my family, we'll still have a home. I mean, right now I don't know if that'll be Hay River or Enterprise or somewhere else, but, you know, we'll find a home.
It's always a pleasure, Winnie, to have you on our show. Thank you for this. Please take care.
Oh, you too. Thank you very much.
Winnie Cadieu lost her home in Enterprise Northwest Territories in the 2023 wildfire. We reached her in Hay River. When Harry Camsell School in Hay River dug up a 25-year-old time capsule, it was supposed to be a happy occasion. And it was, for a lot of people. Former students got a chance to see the writing and artwork they'd produced as children. But for Sherry Cadrone, the occasion felt very different. Her son James was attending the school when the capsule was buried, but he's one of several kids who didn't live to see it unearthed. He died of a drug overdose in 2020. For Ms. Cadrone, that capsule is a painful reminder of the toll the drug crisis has taken on her family and on the community at large. We reached her in Hay River.
Sherry, you're already dealing with so much, and grief can be a very long process, understandably. So when you found out that this time capsule was going to be opened, what kind of emotions did that bring up for you?
Shock, grief. I didn't hear about it till the day that it happened. Mm-hmm. And was contacted by another parent who also had lost her son. It was flabbergasting. Like, there was no heads up. There was no nothing.
The day that it happened, not before, even.
No. No, there was no contact. My mom wanted me to go to see if there was anything there for my son, and I was just too overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. It was definitely a trigger for me. And I never did go. My mom did see his name on written on something in his girly handwriting that he had.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't bring myself to do it.
Do you know what James might have contributed to the time capsule? Do you have a better sense of that now?
No. I do recall back in the day, it probably would have been tech decks, Pokemon cards.
Yeah.
And he was already doing graffiti by the time he was in grade 4, so I'm sure there would have been something along that line.
Yeah. As our listeners heard, your son was not the only student who died before this time capsule was pulled up. What kinds of conversations do you have with other families dealing with this kind of loss and grief?
You know, we kind of stay in contact, and, you know, we share with whatever stage. Some of us are different stages of grief, although grief never ends. But it's an emotional support that, you know, we can understand, and it's not anything we would wish on any parent, but I'm grateful to have those support systems out there that have gone through losing their child. What I've been told is that there are approximately 15 of the kids that were a part of that project have passed on, and the question is how many of them are drug-related, and I know of a handful for sure because I'm in contact with the parents.
It's a staggering number, whatever ultimately the causes of death were. One of your friends that you're in contact with did have items from the time capsule returned to her from her child. What did she tell you about what it was like for her to have those items back?
Well, she was grateful. She was excited because somebody from Hay River was bringing it to her in Yellowknife, and she was quite excited about that. And I envied that she was, you know, prepared to review whatever her son had left.
Hay River is by no means the only place in the country or North America being hit this way by the drug crisis and the loss that crisis brings. What would you want people who don't live in Hay River to understand about what that crisis is doing?
Well, I've worked with a number of youth over the years developing youth programs, and this is an epidemic. It's such a scary hole that they go down into. Like, it's like going down a rabbit hole, and it's like turning left, right, and there's no support. There's no, like, how do they get out of it? And I mean, I appreciate that there is support for people to go for treatment, but it's a lot to get there, for one. And then when they come out of treatment, where is that support afterwards? The smaller communities, we need more of that support, and we need to get rid of the drug dealers. Like, I don't know. Our community is only, what, 3,500 people, ballpark? Yeah. And yet we have some atrocious crimes that have happened here. And it's just, it's mind-boggling. I grew up in Hay River, and it was like a safe, relatively safe place to grow up. And just watching these generations now over the years is like, wow, they don't have that anymore.
Do you get a sense from leaders in the community that they are moving forward with the kind of strategies that can, maybe not tomorrow, but in the months and years ahead, actually make the kind of change that you and others want to see?
I don't know. I think I pretty much lost faith in them. Like, when I was working with the youth a number of years ago, I went to the RCMP, built a partnership with them. They were great, but they were limited. I went to the MLAs, to the mayors, and at the end of the day, this is like, what, 5 years later, and still have not seen any, like, what's changed. I've kind of tossed in the towel, but my heart breaks every time I hear of somebody losing their child. Like, that is a pain that no parent should ever go through.
What would you say to other parents who are experiencing the same kind of loss?
My heart is with you, and the grief doesn't go away. You just got to work through it. Get a good counselor. I swear by that. We do have some online support groups as well that have been very helpful, and it's also helpful for others, because I'm at one stage of grief and another person is at a different stage. And I'm like, oh gosh, I remember that. That's horrible. But with grief, you're always zigzagging around, like, all the different emotions.
Yeah.
And it's just a matter of moving forward.
Before we let you go, I wanted to ask you a bit more about James. What do you want listeners to know about him?
He was fearless. He was an amazing young man. He had no fear. Good golly. He was a commercial fisher on the West Coast. And as well as he started off when he was 17 here in Hay River. He loved life. And when he did try, he was in and out of treatment centers a number of times. And he had just gotten clean for, I think it was 8 months before he had that one fatal dose. That just did it. And now I know he's at peace. I mean, good golly, I probably cry on a regular basis. And in the meantime, I envision him in a happy place.
Sherry, thank you. Thank you so much. Please take care.
All right. Thank you so much.
Sherry Cadrone lost her son James to a drug overdose 5 years ago. She's in Hay River, Northwest Territories. Like many of his neighbors, Jeff Briggio has faced personal challenges. But those challenges opened him up to a new hobby, one that has done wonders for him. Every day, the Hay River man spends hours in the woods, sitting in silence with his camera at the ready, waiting for birds. We reached Mr. Briggio today in Edmonton.
Jeff, I know you're heading back to Hay River today. You're traveling. But when were you last out there birding? What did you see?
A couple of days ago, this past Monday. And the weather wasn't very cooperative. I did manage to see a couple of eagles. I did manage to see a mink that I haven't seen before. It was quite large, actually. I've seen a few smaller birds, Bohemian waxwings, some spruce grouse. That was pretty much it because of the weather. The weather plays a big factor.
Sure. That still sounds like a pretty great Monday out there. This is a daily hobby for you, right?
Yes. Yes, I go out every day, whether it's rain or shine or snow, or it doesn't really matter. Like I have up there, I call it a ditch.
Yeah,
I have to get out and, you know, collect some photos and practice, because practice makes perfect, I guess.
Sure.
You'd say. So,
absolutely.
Yeah.
You had some medical issues, and this is something you picked up after that. What were those issues?
I had a couple of strokes.
Oh, wow. How has all of this helped you heal after that?
Well, the physician that I was seeing, the neurologist, said that I needed to do something for myself that would mentally challenge me and physically, and obviously getting out into the wilderness, getting out into the fresh air, you know, it helps the body for health-wise, you know, with your blood pressure and et cetera, et cetera. And I mean, I've always enjoyed wildlife. I just enjoy it that much more now because I can actually take photos of it and yeah. keep that as a memory.
Yeah. And then the patience of it
yeah,
all. How long are you out there? What is a typical day like?
Some days I'm out there for anywhere between 8 to 12 hours.
Oh, my. You're really committed. You don't do anything halfway.
And I've been doing this for 3 years. But sometimes I'll sit in my truck and I'll just, you know, observe what's going on around me to see if I can find a good location. And then I'll leave my truck and then I'll head into the woods and plant myself down to a dry area if it happens to be snowing or raining or whatever the case may be. And I might grab a hold of some tree boughs and that are, you know, laying around on the ground and build myself a little bit of a ground blind and stay there for a little bit longer. And I mean, I've had some encounters with bears and that kind of thing. And I mean, I'm always prepared. I have, you know, tools of the trade, I'll call them, that allow me to feel that much safer when I'm in the woods. Because, I mean, when you're in deep woods, you can come across just about any kind of animal. If, you know, I mean, and you have to know what to do, because if you don't, then you're
sure.
going to find yourself into a world of hurt.
Yeah, well, you're right. You're certainly right about that. Climate change, yeah. of course, is an issue everywhere for people in Hay River. They felt it quite acutely. What have you seen as you've been, you know, pursuing this hobby over the last several years, the kind of impact on wildlife?
Well, for living in Hay River, the forest fires in the north, the forest fires are a big drawback for not only the people, but obviously the animals, because especially birds, but they have a very sensitive respiratory system. When I see that kind of thing, I might take a photo of a bird maybe flying through the smoke or something like that. I mean, I get bothered, I get hurt by it.
Has this given you, I mean, there's the health aspects of this that you were talking about, but it sounds like there is that deeper sense of community too.
Yes, it's actually, I mean, I was always a person, well, since I've started this adventure, I'll call it, in my life, I've always been one to want to share what I take photos of, whether it be one photo or 50 photos. I do this, you know, for my health, but I also do it for the other people that are home that cannot get out to see what's there. And I know there's a lot of people out there that enjoy wildlife just as much as me or more, and I just feel like it's a privilege for me to be able to do such a thing.
A pleasure speaking with you, Jeff. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jeff Briggio is a photographer in Hay River. We reached Mr. Briggio today in Edmonton.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.
Good evening. You are listening to 91.7.